Morning.
Morning.
Thank you for coming. It's a pleasure to speak to you today. Many of you may not know who I am because, to your credit, you're the people that show up to the earliest session on the last day of a conference. And I'm Daniel Pohl, Manager of Disease Intervention at Howard Brown Health Center in Chicago, one of the nation's largest providers of LGBT health. I'll be speaking about clinical management of discordant syphilis results for our clients. So at Howard Brown, we have a DIS program. Myself, my coworker Mark Pineda, we call her Paloma, and Richie Diesterheft. This was our holiday card this year. And it might surprise you to know that our DIS are themselves gay or bi men from the community, because you wouldn't guess it from the picture, I'm sure. But perhaps some background is good. We've had a DIS program at Howard Brown since 2002. It's a community-embedded program, as they say, although I think that makes us sound like scabies. I prefer community-empowered, maybe. We have presented on the effectiveness of this model in the past, and yesterday in the Late Breaker session, John Cross presented on the fact that it can be replicated, so I do hope in the future to see more DIS programs in CBOs. Some more background. This is just a snapshot of last year, 2009. There are two ways or two algorithms that are used for syphilis testing at Howard Brown that I'll talk about in a couple more slides. But for our clients that come in through walk-in testing, outreach testing, or at our youth center, they are processed by the Illinois Department of Public Health. You can see that accounts for over half of the syphilis tests that were done. Last year we did over 6,000 syphilis tests. Our tests that are done through primary care are processed by commercial labs. And out of those tests, Howard Brown identified 269 new cases of syphilis, just to contextualize my chain smoking and binge drinking. We had 38 primary syphilis, 97 secondary, and 82 early latent. So fairly high morbidity, I'd say. These are the serologies I'll be referencing today. The non-treponemal test, the RPR, which if reactive reflexes to titer, and the two treponemal tests, the FTA, and the TrepSure EIA, which is now currently used by the Illinois Department of Public Health. It's important to note that at Howard Brown, we do not have the ability to do dark field microscopy for patients that may be presenting with a possible primary lesion. So there are many advantages to the EIA. These are just some. And I highlight this to maybe contextualize why the state lab moved to the test. It is quicker. So the test is automated, and many specimens can be processed at once. There's a low labor component, so it's less time consuming. It is objective, meaning that it's a qualitative test, and there is less interpretation bias. They call it robust, or black and white, less equivocals. Reports are generated electronically, so there are less transcriptional errors. Reported higher specificity and sensitivity. There's no prozone reaction, which is sometimes seen in the RPR, particularly during secondary syphilis. And less lab occupational hazard because it involves pipetting. So these are the two algorithms. The Illinois Department of Public Health labs used the RPR first, which is kind of the common model, and that reflects to FTA if positive. In this slide, red is positive and blue is negative. The new algorithm that started in 2008, they used the treponemal test, the EIA, as the initial diagnostic test, and if positive, reflects to RPR. But if the RPR was negative, they did an FTA to confirm the original EIA. So the fact that now there are three tests produced a variety of scenarios and results which before this had not been seen and which introduced new complexity in lab interpretation and clinical management. Our objectives, we wanted to summarize the clinical interpretations of discordant results. There are three varieties of discordancy that I'll be speaking about. The first, where we have a discordantly negative EIA that does not agree with the other treponemal test, FTA. The second scenario, where the two treponemal tests, EIA and FTA, do agree, but they're discordant with the negative RPR. And the third, where the EIA is discordantly positive and does not agree with the negative FTA. All of the syphilis EIAs that were performed between January of 2008 and June of 2009 were analyzed. In addition, some cases of primary syphilis after June of 2009 were examined. So these are our results. Of those EIAs, 382 were seroreactive, a little over 10%, and of those, 151 were associated with new cases of syphilis. The first scenario, maybe in my opinion the most interesting, the EIA was reported out as negative. But these were individuals who had symptoms of primary syphilis, so there was a high suspicion that they did indeed have syphilis. They also had no history of syphilis, so when we got an EIA that was reported out as negative, we asked the state lab to run additional serologies for these patients. In other words, they would have been missed by EIA alone. This chart shows 9 clients of Howard Brown. They're listed chronologically. The first 4 through May of 2009 were the 4 that we referenced in our abstract. The last 5 happened since then. And so it kind of gives you a snapshot of ages, HIV status, the duration of their primary lesion. All of them have penile lesions, and whether or not they had an RPR titer. Again, all of them were MSM with no prior history of syphilis, and all of them had a fully reactive FTA. The HIV status is by self-report. So I think it's important to note that we all know, or hopefully it's well known, that syphilis serology is often false negative during primary stage syphilis. That's not a surprise. And that it can take a few days of having a lesion before you would expect to see serology turn positive. But it was fairly surprising to us that based on what we've seen, the FTA has the best sensitivity to detect primary syphilis, followed by the RPR. And third, the TrepSure EIA. We expect treponemal tests to turn positive before non-treponemal tests, but for these, for 6 of these clients that had titers, that was not the case. 3 of them did have non-reactive RPRs, but with no prior history of syphilis, the FTA being reactive was diagnostic. It is also interesting to note that these 3 individuals had an onset of lesion that was much sooner than some of the other people. And some of these people had lesions that had been there for over 3 weeks, and the EIA was reported out as negative. The second scenario that we described with both treponemal tests positive, these were clients who were asymptomatic and did not have a history of syphilis, so we considered them to be syphilis positive and treated them as such. This represented 0.5% of all of our tests and 12% of the new cases. They would have been missed by RPR alone. The third scenario, with the EIA discordantly positive, we actually got more than 22 of these results, but of the people with these results, 22 of them were clients with no known history of syphilis, no symptoms, no known contacts, and so the recommendation at that time was to retest them at 2 weeks to rule out seroconversion to syphilis positive, the thought being that the EIA might show positive before the other tests. But of the 17 of the 22 that we were able to get back in for retesting at 2 weeks, we saw similar results on their retest. None of them turned positive on RPR or FTA. And again, none of them had symptoms. So we considered these false positive EIAs. Some limitations of the study. A number of false negative EIAs is probably higher than reported. There are often occult lesions in any population, especially in this one. We see a lot more secondary syphilis, and we assume that that's because a person had an occult lesion in the rectum or in the mouth. For the screening clinic, if a person comes in, they meet with a counselor, but they do not meet with a clinician or DIS, meaning that if they do have a primary sore, they might not bring it up to the counselor, or if they do, the counselor might not address it. So there was no expanded or enhanced capability to request additional serologies for some people. Additionally, if we're looking at the rate of false positives, we're not able to compare to false positive RPRs from before 2008, although we guess that because the RPR is less specific, that that there are probably a lot more false positives or biologic false positives on RPR. This may not be generalizable to other populations. It's an LGBT health center, and our clients with syphilis are almost all MSM, many of them HIV impacted. Some conclusions. Some primary syphilis cases would not have been identified with EIA testing alone. We recommend that additional serology be considered in patients where there's a high suspicion of syphilis or possible primary symptoms. It appears the EIA appears more effective than the RPR alone at detecting latent syphilis, particularly latent syphilis. These might be people who were incidentally treated at some point, but in any case, it certainly they would be missed by RPR alone. And retesting clients with no history of syphilis who were discordantly EIA positive did not result in detection of any new syphilis cases. Therefore, retesting may not be necessary. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, all of the staff of Howard Brown, in particular the DIS, the IDPH syphilis serology staff, as well as all of our coworkers at IDPH and CDPH, the clients of Howard Brown, and to you for coming this morning. Thank you very much.
because I think we anecdotally in North Carolina, where we're seeing a real resurgence of syphilis, are very concerned with EIAs that were missing primary syphilis. And the belief is for a lot of clinicians, I think it's more sensitive, I think similar to the FDA, TPPA, and so they're not treating folks. And that's probably a gross underestimation because we don't know the number of people with lesions that are completely missed. So I think there really needs to be something addressed, whether it comes out in MMWR saying, look, given the resurgence of syphilis and MSM, a new algorithm around that. And the second part is the whole idea of not going after partners for folks that are discordant.
Right.
Because it's a real waste of time. You know, it's a personal decision. Who knows if they have syphilis or not? But we've also seen the same thing. They're not linked to any other cases. They're not infectious.
Right.
And I think given the burden for DIS, again, something from CDC to clarify that would be really useful.
All right, well, thank you, Peter. And I think I'll call on Ron Ballard, our lab director, who might have something to say about that.
Thanks. I was a little concerned that you're calling EIA positives, RPR negatives, syphilis. Because, you know, the vast majority of those are going to be previously treated. And what's going to happen is you're going to send people out looking for partners and creating all kinds of problems. Not only that, you're going to end up with treating the same people time and time again, because they're going to remain positive for the rest of their life. The other thing which I think, just to address the other concern, is that we know only too well that a fair proportion of patients with primary syphilis are going to be seronegative. And, you know, it all depends on the sort of the index of suspicion if you don't have dark field or PCR to be able to tell you whether that lesion is actually syphilis or not.
Sure.
So you would have to call back those patients, either that or treat them presumptively. So, you know, unfortunately, syphilis serology is not an exact science by any means.
Oh, believe me, I know.
So, but my real concern is the over-treatment and stretching of resources as a result of calling something which is an EIA positive a true syphilis case. And that certainly isn't the case.
All right, we're going to take one more question. Sue?
Hi, thanks for the presentation. You know, one thought, though, as we try to figure our way through the whole EIA positive, RPR negative dilemma is you're actually working with a very high-risk population.
Exactly.
And so that when you have those discordants, whereas Ron suggested that those discordants should just not be called syphilis because they're going to be treated over and over. You see, I would suggest that maybe these are exactly the guys we should just treat anyway.
Oh, they were all offered treatment.
And, you know, it doesn't matter like what the following is, the likelihood that they are in a sexual network that will at some point contact syphilis.
Sure.
We've got a bug that's exquisitely sensitive to penicillin. We haven't found resistance at this point, not good. And, you know, and maybe that's the biggest contribution that we can make.
All right. Well, thank you, and thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.